This is Audible.
Putnam Berkeley Audio presents Valhalla Rising by Clive Cussler, read by Ron McClarty. June, 10:35. They moved through the morning mist like ghosts, silent and eerie in phantom ships. Tall serpentine prows arched gracefully on bow and stern, crowned with intricately carved dragons, teeth bared menacingly in a growl, as if their eyes were piercing the vapor in search of victims. Meant to incite fear into the crew's enemies, the dragons were also believed to be protection against the evil spirits that lived in the sea. The little band of immigrants had come across a hostile sea in long, elegantly shaped black hulls that skimmed the waves with the ease and stability of trout in a peaceful brook. Long oars reached from holes in the hulls and dipped into the dark water, pulling the ships through the waves. Their square red and white striped sails hung limp in the listless air. Small lapstrake boats 20 feet long and carrying extra cargo were tied to the sterns and towed behind. These people were the precursors of those who would come much later. Men, women, and their children, along with their meager possessions, including livestock. Of the paths Norsemen had blazed across the oceans, none was more dangerous than the great voyage across the North Atlantic. Despite the perils of the unknown, they boldly sailed through the ice floes, struggled under the gale-force winds, fought monstrous waves, and endured vicious storms that surged out of the southwest. Most had survived. But two of the 8 ships that had set out from Norway were lost and never seen again. Finally, the storm-worn colonists reached the west coast of Newfoundland, but instead of landing at Lons-en-Meadows, the site of Leif Erikson's earlier settlement, they were determined to explore farther south in the hope of finding a warmer climate for their new colony. After skirting a very large island, they steered a southwesterly course until they reached a long arm of land that curved northward from the mainland. Rounding the tip of the seemingly unending stretch of sand, they encountered a wide bay. The little fleet of ships entered the calmer waters and sailed west, helped along by an incoming tide. A fog bank rolled over them, casting a damp blanket of moisture over the water. When first light came, the fog had been replaced with a light mist, and it could be seen that the bay narrowed into a fjord that flowed into the sea. The men rowed into the current as their women and children stared quietly at the high palisades that emerged from the dying mist on the west bank of the river. What seemed to them to be giant trees forested the rolling land behind the crest. Though they saw no sign of life, they suspected they were being watched by human eyes hidden among the trees. Every time they had come ashore for water, they had been harassed by the Skraelings, their term for any foreign-born natives that lived in the alien country they hoped to colonize. The Skraelings had not proven friendly, and on more than one occasion had unleashed clouds of arrows against the ships. The expedition leader, Bjarn Sigvatsson, had not allowed his warriors to fight back. He knew well that other colonists from Vinland and Greenland had been plagued by the Skraelings too, a situation caused when the Vikings had murdered several of the innocent inhabitants purely out of a barbaric love of killing. This trip, Sigvatsson would demand that the native inhabitants be treated in a friendly manner. Sigvatsson, gazing through the dying mist into the distance, pointed to a shadow in the steep rock palisades. "Pull toward the left bank," he ordered the rowers. "There looks to be an opening in the cliffs where we can shelter for the night." As they drew closer, the dark, forbidding entrance of a flooded cavern grew in size until it broadened enough for a ship to enter. They found themselves in a high-ceilinged grotto that was easily large enough to hold a fleet of ships 3 times the size of the little Viking fleet. Though their ancestors had embraced Christianity, old pagan traditions died hard. Naturally formed grottos were regarded as the dwelling places of the gods. The walls on the interior of the grotto had been worn smooth by the waves of an ancient sea against the volcanic rock layers that were an extension of nearby mountains. They arched upward into a domed ceiling. The water level stopped at a ledge that ascended 3 feet and stretched into the inner reaches of the cavern for a distance of nearly 200 feet. Sigvatsson shouted through the grotto entrance for the other ships to follow. As the ships approached the landing, long gangplanks were run out and everyone scurried onto dry land, happy to stretch their legs for the first time in days. After eating and just before settling in for the night in their leather sleeping bags, two of Sigvatsson's young children, an 11-year-old boy and 10-year-old girl, came running up to him, shouting excitedly. They grabbed his big hands and began dragging him into the deepest part of the cavern. Lighting torches, they led him into a long tunnel barely large enough to stand in. It was a tube passage, a rounded cave system originally formed when underwater. After climbing over and around fallen rock, they ascended upward for 200 feet. Then the children stopped and motioned to a small crevice.
"Father, look! Look!" cried the girl. "There is a hole leading outside. You can see the stars."
Sigvatsson saw that the hole was too small and narrow for even the children to crawl through, but he could clearly see the nighttime sky. The next day, he put several men to work smoothing the tunnel floor to ease access. When the opening was expanded so a man could walk through while standing straight, they found themselves stepping into a large meadow bordered by stout trees. The supply of lumber to build houses was limitless. The ground was thick with wildflowers and grass to graze their livestock. It was on this generous land, high above the beautiful blue fjord, bountiful with fish, that Sigvatsson would build his colony. In the following months, the colonists built thick wooden longhouses with massive beams to support a sod roof. Hungry for rich land, they wasted no time in planting crops. They harvested berries and netted fish in great abundance from the fjord. The Skraelings proved curious yet reasonably friendly. Trinkets, cloth, and cow's milk were traded for valuable furs and game. Sigvatsson wisely ordered his men to keep their swords, axes, and spears out of sight. With spring, Sigvatsson prepared to send out a large scouting expedition to explore the new and strange land. He chose to remain behind to assume the duties and responsibilities of running the now thriving little community. He picked his younger brother, Magnus, to lead the expedition. What was to have been a 2-month scouting expedition turned into an epic journey of 14 months. Sailing and rowing, except when they had to haul their boats overland to the next waterway, the men traveled on wide rivers and across enormous lakes that seemed as vast as the great northern sea. 300 miles down the great waterway, they came ashore and launched a year-long trek through rolling hills and endless grasslands. Many months later, they came to a halt when they saw the peaks of great mountains rising in the distance. In awe of the great land that seemed to go on forever, they decided it was time to turn back and reach the colony before the first snows of winter. But when the weary travelers finally reached the settlement in midsummer, they found that the entire colony had been burned to the ground, and all that was left of their comrades, wives, and children were scattered bones. Magnus and the surviving Norsemen discovered that the opening to the tunnel leading down to the cavern where the ships were stored had been covered over with rocks and brush by the late inhabitants and hidden from the Skraelings. Somehow the settlers had managed to hide the treasures and sacred relics Sigvatsson had plundered in his younger days, along with their most cherished personal possessions, concealing them in the ships during the Skraelings' attack. Wild with grief and rage, the warriors collected the remains of their friends and families and carried them down the tunnel to the cavern, where they placed them in the ships. It was part of their traditional ceremony to send the dead to a glorious hereafter in Valhalla. Traditionally, the ships and their dead would have been buried, but that was not possible. They feared that the Skraelings would dig up and plunder the dead. so the saddened warriors hammered and chiseled at a huge rock above the grotto's entrance until it dropped in a massive spill along with tons of smaller boulders, effectively sealing off the cavern from the surface of the river. The ceremony completed, the Norsemen prepared themselves for battle. When ready, Magnus Sigvatsson led his force of 100 men toward the large village of the Skraelings, 3 miles distant from the massacre. There was no attempt at guile or stealth. The Vikings stormed out of the trees, howling like mad dogs. Nearly 200 Skraelings were slaughtered by the ferocious savagery of the unexpected assault before they could grasp what was happening. Quickly, in groups of 5 and 10 men, they began to fight back. Magnus charged ahead of his warriors, fighting two-handed with spear in one hand, gigantic battle axe in the other, both dripping crimson. He was what the Vikings called a berserker, a word that would pass down the centuries as berserk, a seemingly crazed man intent on striking terror in the minds of his enemies. He shrieked like a maniac as he hurled himself at the Skraelings, felling many with his flailing axe. The Skraeling village became soaked in blood, but still the Skraeling replacements kept coming, and eventually the tide began to turn. Overwhelmingly outnumbered and severely weakened from wounds and exhaustion, the Vikings were whittled down until only 10 were left, standing around Magnus Sigvatsson. The few who were left fought to the brutal end, enduring an avalanche of blows by hatchets made of stone until they could endure no more. To a man they perished, sword and axe in hand. To the Vikings living in Iceland and Norway, the fate of Bjarn Sigvatsson's colony became a mystery. No one was left alive to tell their story, and no other immigrant explorers followed in their path across the truculent seas. The colonists became a forgotten footnote in the sagas passed down through the ages. February 2nd, 1894, the Caribbean Sea. No one on board the old wooden-hulled warship Kearsarge could have foreseen the catastrophe that was about to strike. Displaying the flag and protecting United States interest in the West Indies, she was on a voyage from Haiti to Nicaragua when her lookout spotted a strange shape in the water a mile off the starboard bow. The black humped back of a strange species of sea monster could clearly be seen with the naked eye.
"What do you make of it?"
Captain Lee Hunt asked his first officer, Lieutenant James Ellis, as he stared through a pair of brass binoculars. Ellis squinted through a telescope. "My first guess is that it's a whale, but I've never seen one move so steadily through the water without showing its tail or diving beneath the surface. Also, there's a strange mound protruding forward of its center." Ellis put down the telescope and turned to Hunt. "Shall we investigate, sir?" Hunt nodded.
"Order a 10-degree turn to starboard. Request Chief Engineer Gribble to increase our speed to full. Turn out the crew for gun station 2 and double the lookouts. I don't want to lose sight of that monster, whatever it is."
Soon the Kearsarge began to close with the strange object that neither increased nor decreased its speed. A gun crew assembled, rammed a power charge and a projectile down the barrel of a 20-pound rifled gun, and stood back.
"Put a shot 50 yards ahead the monster's nose," Hunt shouted through his megaphone.
It was a near-perfect shot, and the shell splashed directly in front of the giant hump. Animal or machine, it ignored the intrusion and maintained its speed and course without the slightest deviation. All hands except the engine room crew were lining the rails now, gazing at the monster that was closer to the bow of the ship with every passing minute. Then the mound on its back flashed and glinted.
"If I didn't know better," said Hunt, "I'd say the sun is reflecting off some kind of window or port."
The gun crew reloaded and fired another shot that struck with a great splash between 15 and 20 yards forward of the monster. As they watched, the strange object slowly slid beneath the waves until it vanished from view. The Kearsarge passed directly over the spot where it sank, but the crew could detect no sign of it in the depths.
"She's gone, Captain!" one of the seamen called to Hunt. "Keep a sharp eye out for it," Hunt shouted back. "Some of you men take to the rigging for a better view."
The hours passed, and sunset came as the Kearsarge cruised in ever-widening circles in a fading hope of finding the monster again. Captain Hunt was about to break off the pursuit when a lookout in the rigging shouted down to the deck,
"Monster off the port beam, about 1,000 yards, heading our way."
The officers and crew rushed to the port railing and stared out over the water. It appeared to be coming directly toward the Kearsarge at a very rapid rate of speed. 6 of the Kearsarge's 8 guns roared, their explosive blasts shattering the air as fire and smoke spouted from their muzzles. Staring through his binoculars, Hunt could see the shell from the 20-pounder rifled gun strike the monster's back, bounce into the air, and ricochet across the water like a skipping stone.
"She's armored," he said, stunned.
Unfazed, their nemesis aimed its bow unerringly amidships of the Kearsarge's hull, increasing its speed and gathering momentum for the blow. Several of the officers stood on the railing, grasping the rigging with one hand while firing their revolvers with the other. A typhoon of bullets merely glanced off the armored hull. Hunt and his crew stared in disbelief at the nightmare that was about to ram the ship. But the expected shock never came. All any of the crew felt was a slight shudder beneath the decks. The only sound was the faint crunch of shredding wood. In that frozen moment of time, the unearthly thing had slashed between the Kearsarge's great oak ribs as cleanly as a murderer's knife thrust, penetrating deep inside the hull just aft of the engine room. Hunt gaped in shock. He could see a face through the large transparent viewport on the pyramid-shaped housing on top of the underwater ram. The bearded face had what seemed to be a sad and melancholy expression, as if the man inside felt remorse for the disaster his strange and bizarre vessel had caused. Then the mysterious vessel quickly backed off and fell away into the depths. Hunt knew the Kearsarge was doomed. Down below, seawater poured into the aft cargo hold and galley. He stared at a low coral island not 2 miles away, turned to the helmsman and shouted,
"Steer for that reef off the starboard beam!"
Not long afterwards, the Kearsarge drove onto the coral bottom of the reef, her keel and hull gouging a path until she came to an abrupt stop and rolled over until she rested on a list of 15 degrees.
"Praise the Lord, we're saved," murmured the helmsman, still gripping the spokes of the wheel.
Ellis stared thoughtfully over the turquoise Caribbean water. "I seem to remember reading something once about one of our warships," he said to Hunt. "The Abraham Lincoln encountered a mysterious metal monster about 30 years ago. It tore her rudder off."
"Where was this?" asked Hunt.
"I believe it was the Sea of Japan, and at least 4 British warships have disappeared under mysterious circumstances over the past 20 years.
"The Navy Department will never believe what happened here," said Hunt, looking around his wrecked ship with growing anger. "I'll be lucky if I don't get court-martialed and drummed out of the service."
But strangely, when Hunt and his crew returned to the United States, there was no board of inquiry, a very unusual circumstance. It was as if the Secretary of the Navy and the admirals wanted to sweep the incident quietly under the carpet. To Captain Hunt's surprise, he was elevated in rank to full captain before his honorable retirement. Congress authorized $45,000 to raise the Kearsarge from the reef and tow her home to a shipyard, but it was found that natives from nearby islands had set her on fire to salvage her brass, copper, and iron. Her guns were removed, and the salvagers returned to port, leaving her hulk to disintegrate in a coral tomb.
July 15th, 2003, the South Pacific Ocean. If the disaster had been planned months in advance, with meticulous insight and judgment, it could not have been more catastrophic. The luxurious cruise ship, Emerald Dolphin, was on fire,
and no one on board had the slightest trace of suspicion of the danger. Yet flames were slowly devouring the interior of the ship's wedding chapel, located amidships just forward of the sumptuous shopping village. On the bridge, the officers went about their watch oblivious to the pending disaster. None of the ship's automatic fire warning systems hinted at a problem. The console, with its schematic profile of the entire ship that displayed every fire warning indicator, was a sea of green lights. At 4 a.m., the passengers were all asleep in their staterooms. The bars and lounges, magnificent casino, nightclub, and ballroom were empty as the Emerald Dolphin plowed the South Seas at 24 knots on a cruise from Sydney, Australia, to the islands of Tahiti. The Emerald Dolphin was on her maiden voyage. She did not have the flowing, elegant lines of other cruise ships. Her hull looked more like a giant hiking boot with a huge disc in the center. The entire superstructure of six decks was round and circled 150 feet beyond and above both sides of the hull and 50 feet over the bow and stern. The pride of the Blue Seas Cruise Lines, the new ship would unquestionably receive a 6-star rating and was expected to become a very popular vessel. The marine architects of the Emerald Dolphin had gone over the top, creating ultra-modern glitz in the 5 dining rooms, 3 bar and lounge areas, the casino, ballroom, theater, and staterooms. Glass in wildly different colors abounded throughout the ship. Chrome, brass, and copper swirled on the walls and ceilings. All the furniture was created by contemporary artists and celebrity interior designers. The sports deck featured a short 4-hole golf course, Olympic-sized swimming pool, basketball court, and a huge workout gym. A shopping avenue 2 city blocks long rose 3 decks high and might have been taken from the Emerald City of Oz. The staterooms were circular with no sharp corners. The beds were raised with extremely soft mattresses, beamed with soft overhead lights. The bathrooms had built-in chambers that dispersed mist, spray, rain, or steam amid a jungle of flowering tropical plants that looked as though they had been grown on an alien planet. No passenger who went to bed that night would have thought that the old Grim Reaper was about to swing his scythe at the Emerald Dolphin. Captain Jack Waitkiss made a brief inspection of the upper decks before retiring to his cabin. Old by most standards, Waitkiss was only 5 days away from his 65th birthday. He had been named commander of the Emerald Dolphin's maiden voyage in honor of his distinguished service to the company. He made one final call to the bridge and was told all was normal before he drifted off to sleep. At 4:10 a.m., Second Officer Charles McFerrin thought he caught a distinct whiff of smoke as he made a routine tour of the ship. Mystified because no alarm had been sounded, he followed the acrid scent along the shopping avenue until he stood in front of the wedding chapel. Sensing heat on the other side, he pulled the door open. The interior of the chapel was a raging mass of flames. Stunned, McFerrin stumbled backward. He quickly recovered and called the bridge on his radio communicator. "Wake up, Captain Waitkiss. We have a fire in the chapel. Sound the alarm, program the damage control computer, and engage the fire control systems." First Officer Vince Sheffield automatically turned to the fire systems console. "McFerrin, are you sure? We have no indication here." "Trust me," McFerrin shouted into the mouthpiece. "It's an inferno, and it's out of control."
"Are the sprinklers activated?" Sheffield demanded.
"No, the fire extinguishing system is not operating, and there was no heat alarm."
Sheffield was at a loss. Staring at the console that showed all was well, he wasted precious seconds vacillating before he finally called and reported the blaze to the fire crew officer and then woke Captain Waitkiss. In disbelief, the captain hurriedly dressed and went to check for himself. He entered the bridge elevator, rode down to A deck, and approached the wedding chapel from the side opposite the crew fighting the fire. Unthinkingly, unaware of the enormity of the danger, He jerked open the door behind the altar. A storm of flame burst through the doorway and engulfed him. Captain Jack Waitkus died horribly, never knowing that his ship was about to die too. Kelly Egan awoke and sat up, slowly becoming aware of the faint smell of smoke. She threw back the covers and set her bare feet on the carpet. The carpet seemed abnormally warm. Concerned, she pulled a robe over her shoulders and padded across the floor to the door leading to the adjoining stateroom occupied by her father. Dr. Elmore Egan was in a deep sleep, as evidenced by his snoring. A Nobel Prize-winning mechanical genius, he was traveling on the Emerald Dolphin because she carried the revolutionary new engines that he had designed and developed, and he was making a study of how they were performing on their first voyage. Kelly leaned across his bed and shook him lightly by the shoulder. "Dad, wake up." A light sleeper, Egan came instantly awake. "What is it? Are you ill?"
"I smell smoke," Kelly answered, "and the floor feels hot."
Fully awake, Egan leaned out of bed and placed both palms on the carpet. He sniffed the air.
"Get dressed," he said. "We're going on deck."
On the A-deck shopping avenue outside the wedding chapel, the crew was retreating in its battle against the fire. The portable extinguishers were used up. All the fire control systems were inoperative, and to add to their desperation, the hoses could not be attached because the valve caps were frozen closed and could not be removed by hand. It was as if they had been welded shut. To the men fighting the fire, frustration turned to terror as the situation worsened. With the fire doors unable to close, there was no way to isolate the blaze. McFerrin hailed the bridge.
"Tell the captain we're losing control down here. Is there any way the engine room can override the systems and close the fire doors?"
"Negative," answered Sheffield, anxiety obvious in his voice. "The entire fire control program is down. Computers, fire doors, sprinklers, the works. They've all failed."
"Why haven't you sounded the alarm?"
"I can't alarm the passengers without the captain's authority."
"Where is he?"
"He went down to judge the situation for himself. Haven't you seen him?"
Surprised, McFerrin searched the area but saw no sign of Waitkus.
"He's not here."
"Then he must be on his way back to the bridge," replied Sheffield, becoming uneasy.
"For the safety of the passengers, give the alarm and send them to their lifeboat stations in preparation for abandoning the ship."
Sheffield was aghast.
"Order 1,600 passengers to abandon the Emerald Dolphin? You're overreacting."
"For the love of God, man," McFerrin shouted. "Give the alarm and warn the passengers. Unless you can get the fire control systems operational in the next 5 minutes, this ship and everybody on it is doomed."
Bells clanged, and sirens whooped throughout the ship. Drugged by sleep, 1,600 passengers came awake, confused and questioning the harsh interruption. Dr. Egan had led his daughter to the observation deck on the upper section of the superstructure, where they could get an overall view of the ship. His worst fears were confirmed when he saw the conflagration rolling from amidships 7 decks below. On the stern, the crew was feverishly throwing canisters containing life rafts into the sea, where they were ejected and automatically inflated. He spoke sharply to Kelly.
"Go down to the open cafe on B deck and wait there. I must retrieve my papers from my stateroom. I'll be along in a few minutes."
Hordes of frightened passengers poured into every passage and companionway, every elevator. People who lived responsible and disciplined lives had suddenly become pitiful rabble, overcome with the fear of death. The crew, the officers, stewards, and stateroom stewardesses all did their best to control the chaos, but it was a lost cause. Without the haven of the lifeboats, there was no place for anyone to go but over the side into the water. Kelly pushed her way through the throng until she reached the railing, then hung onto it in a death grip. A woman was moaning hysterically.
"We'll be burned alive. I don't want to die in a fire."
Before anyone could stop her, she climbed over the rail and jumped into the sea. Kelly began to fear for her father. She was contemplating going back to their staterooms to look for him when he reappeared, carrying a brown leather case.
"Oh, Dad," she cried. "I was afraid I'd lost you."
"It's bedlam, absolute bedlam," he gasped, short of breath, his face flushed.
"What can we do?" she asked anxiously. "Where can we go?"
"In the water," answered Egan. "It's our only hope to stay alive as long as we can."
He looked solemnly into his daughter's eyes. They sparkled like blue sapphires when the light hit them just right. He could never help marveling at how much she looked like her mother, Lana, at the same age. Their height and weight and body shapes were identical, both tall, finely contoured. Kelly's long, straight, maple-sugar brown hair, framing a strong face with high cheekbones, sculptured lips and perfect nose, were a mirror image, too. Both Kelly and her father had been devastated when Lana had died after a long battle with breast cancer. Now, as he stood there on the burning ship, his heart felt an indescribable heaviness at realizing that Kelly's own life was in dire jeopardy of being cut short. She smiled at him gamely. "At least we're in the tropics, and the water will be warm enough for a swim." He squeezed her shoulders, and then looked down into the sea that was rushing past the great hull nearly 50 feet below.
"We'll wait until the absolute last minute before we go over," he said. "There are bound to be ships coming to rescue us."
McFerrin burst onto the bridge.
"Have any ships responded to our Mayday call?" he asked Sheffield.
Sheffield stared blankly.
"Mayday?
Didn't you give our position and request immediate assistance?"
"Yes, we must send out a call for help,"
Sheffield muttered vaguely.
McFerrin immediately read the incoherence in Sheffield's tone and eyes and was horrified.
"Oh, God, it's probably too late. The flames must have reached the radio room."
He snatched up a phone and called the radio room, but heard only static. 12 miles to the south, a pair of opaline green eyes gazed into the brightening sky to the east before turning and examining the red glow on the northern horizon. Absorbed, the man stepped from the bridge wing into the pilot house of the Numa Oceanographic Survey Vessel Deep Encounter, picked up a pair of strong binoculars, and returned. Slowly, deliberately, he focused the glasses and stared into the distance. He was a tall man, 3 inches more than 6 feet, and a lean 185 pounds. His every movement seemed consciously planned. The black hair was wavy, almost shaggy, with a touch of gray beginning to show on the temples. The tanned skin and the craggy features revealed a love of the outdoors. As Special Projects Director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency, Dirk Pitt spent 9 months of each year at sea. On this expedition, the NUMA scientists were conducting a deep-water geological survey in the Tonga Trench. After studying the glow for 3 minutes, he retraced his path into the pilot house and leaned into the radio room.
"Have you picked up any distress signals in the last hour?"
The operator shook his head.
"I had a short conversation with the radio man on board a British container ship around 1 o'clock, but no distress signal."
"A large ship off to the north looks like it's on fire. See if you can make contact with her."
Pitt touched Leo Delgado, the officer on duty, on the shoulder.
"Leo, I'd like you to turn the ship north and proceed at full speed. I believe we have a ship on fire. Wake Captain Birch and ask him to come to the pilot house."
Though Pitt was head of the project and outranked Birch, the captain still commanded the ship. Kermit Birch came almost immediately, wearing only a pair of polka-dot shorts.
"What's this about a ship on fire?" he asked Pitt, suppressing a yawn.
Pitt explained what he had seen. Birch grinned.
"You gave the same order I would have given."
He stepped over to the ship's phone.
"Engine room, rouse Marvin out of bed. I want every revolution he can get out of the engines."
After the news went out, the survey ship came alive as crew and scientists were assigned special duties. The ship's 2 35-foot hydrographic survey launches were made ready to drop in the water. Slings were attached to the two telescoping deck cranes used to raise and lower submersibles and survey equipment so that people could be pulled from the water. Every ladder and rope on the ship was coiled to be thrown over the sides along with cradles to lift children and the elderly on board. The ship's doctor, with the assistance of the marine scientists, prepared the hospital and a casualty station in the mess room. Officers instructed crewmen to channel survivors onto different parts of the ship to be cared for, as well as act as ballast. If the hoard that was expected to come on board was not placed strategically to balance the ship, it could roll over and capsize. The deep encounter was only rated at a top speed of 16 knots, but Chief Engineer Marvin House pulled every ounce of power from his two big 3,000-horsepower diesel-electric propulsion engines. 17 knots became 18, then 19, until the bow was thrusting through the sea at 20 knots. Captain Birch ordered the radio operator to contact other ships in the area. There were only two within 100 miles. One was the Earl of Wattlesfield, the British container ship the radio operator had contacted earlier. Her captain had quickly responded and was coming at full speed, but he was 37 miles to the east. The second vessel was an Australian missile cruiser that had changed course and was charging toward the position given by Birch, but she had 63 miles to go. Satisfied there was nothing left to consider, Birch joined Pitt on the bridge wing. Every soul who did not have a duty to perform lined the rails, staring at the red glow lighting the sky. 70% of the once beautiful ship was a vortex of flames. Already, her superstructure was a twisted, seething tangle of red-hot steel that virtually divided the ship in two. The interior support bulkheads had contorted into a mass of melted and scorched metal. The lifeboats, or what was left of them, hung in their davits, barely recognizable.
"Good Lord," mumbled Birch. "No one got away in the boats."
Their first impression was that nobody could have been left alive in such a holocaust. But then the great mob of people became visible, choked together on five of the liner's open stern decks. At the sight of the deep encounter, a steady stream of them began to leap into the water and swim to water. Birch leaned over the railing and shouted an order to his crew.
"Away the boats! Get to those people before they float out of sight!"
"Can you bring Deep Encounter under the stern?" asked Pitt.
"You mean put our ship alongside?"
"Yes."
Birch looked skeptical.
"I won't be able to get close enough for them to jump on board."
"The nearer the fire gets to them, the more we'll leap over the side. Hundreds will die before we can pick them all out of the water. If we tie up to the stern, her crew can throw lines for the passengers to slide down to our deck."
Birch looked at Pitt.
"In this sea, we'll beat hell out of Deep Encounter against that monster. Our hull plates will be crushed and open to the sea. We could easily sink ourselves as well."
"Better to try and sink alongside than never to try at all," Pitt said philosophically. "I'll take full responsibility for the ship from my end."
"You're right, of course,"
Birch agreed. He took over the helm and began orchestrating the controls of the two omnidirectional Z-drives and jet bow thrusters of the survey ship, gently nudging her starboard hull sideways against the massive stern of the Emerald Dolphin. Not yet realizing Pitt and Birch's intent, Second Officer McFerrin, who had struggled down from the bridge and reached the stern with a bullhorn to help in calming the passengers, called out across the water,
"To the ship off our stern, do not come any closer. There are people in the water."
Pitt snatched his own bullhorn and shouted back, "Understood. Our boats will pick them up as fast as possible. Stand by. We're going to approach and tie next to you. Please have your crew ready to take aboard our lines."
McFerrin was astonished. He couldn't believe the Numa captain and crew were willing to risk their own lives and ship in a daring rescue attempt.
"How many can you take on board?" he inquired.
"How many have you got?" Pitt asked back.
"Over 2,000, up to 2,500.
Birch groaned.
"We'll sink like a rock with 2,000 people piled on the decks.
Pitt shouted back to the officer on the deck. Other rescue ships are on the way. We'll take all if we can. Have your crew drop lines so your passengers can descend to our deck.
Birch smoothly worked the propulsion controls, moving his ship slowly forward, then manipulating the bow thrusters with a deft hand, swinging his ship toward the liner inches at a time. Then came the scraping sound of steel against steel. 30 seconds later, the two ships were firmly lashed together. Hawsers were passed over by the survey ship's crew, while the cruise liner's crew uncoiled lines and threw them over the sides, their ends trailing into the waiting hands of the scientists who hurriedly tied them to any object that held firm. The instant all lines were secure, Pitt shouted for the Emerald Dolphin's crew to begin lowering the passengers.
"Families with children first," McFerrin shouted through his bullhorn.
The old tradition of women and children first was commonly ignored by modern seamen in favor of keeping families intact. For a while, the evacuation seemed to be going efficiently, without bottlenecks. But as the fire came closer, the heat intensified, and the fumes made it difficult to breathe. The crowd turned back into a frightened mob. Suddenly, there was a mad rush by those who decided to take their chances in the water rather than wait their turn to shimmy down the lines to safety. They fell like rain, colliding with those already floating in the water. Several miscalculated and dropped onto the deck of the deep encounter, sustaining major injuries or dying on impact. Others fell between the ships and were crushed to death when the wave action pushed the hulls together. The Emerald Dolphin's crew did their best to instruct the passengers on how to jump. To strike the water with their arms over their head meant the impact would tear the life vest over their heads, leaving them to stay afloat on their own. Those who did not grasp the collar of the life vest and pull down upon impact ran the risk of breaking their necks. Before long, a small sea of dead bodies was drifting into the debris alongside the two ships. Kelly was scared. The little survey ship looked so close, yet seemed so far. There were only 10 people ahead of them on one of the lines attached to the vessel below. Suddenly, a heavy man with red hair and a mustache that stretched across his cheeks to his sideburns emerged from the human surge and tried to snatch Dr. Egan's leather case from his hands. Initially stunned, the engineer managed to hold onto the case in a death grip and refused to release it. In horror, Kelly watched the struggle between the two men. An officer in an immaculate uniform stood watching with what seemed total indifference. He was a black man with a face of hardened obsidian, his features chiseled and sharp.
"Do something!" Kelly screamed at him. "Help my father!"
But the officer simply ignored her, stepped forward, and to Kelly's astonishment, began to help the red-haired man in his struggle for the leather case. Pushed by the combined physical force of the two men, Egan lost his balance and pitched overboard headfirst. Startled by the unexpected movement, the black officer and red-haired man froze, then melted back into the crowd. Kelly screamed and looked down just in time to see her father strike the water with a huge splash. His head rose to the surface. His life vest was gone, having been torn from his body by the impact. His head dipped forward and rolled listlessly. Suddenly, Kelly felt hands around her throat, squeezing relentlessly. She frantically kicked backward while attempting futilely to pull the hands from her throat. In what was a lucky thrust, her foot caught the attacker in the groin. There was a sudden intake of breath, and the pressure on her throat was relaxed. She spun around and saw that it was the black officer again. Then the red-haired man pushed the black man out of the way and launched himself at Kelly. But she clutched the collar of her life vest, leaped clear of the railing, and dropped into the void, just as the red-haired man reached out for her. Down she plunged in an explosion of bubbles as the sea closed over her. She stroked upward, helped by her life vest, before she finally burst into the air. She sucked in several deep breaths as she looked around for her father and saw him floating limply about 30 feet away from the scorched hull of the cruise ship. She frantically swam to him, put one arm around his shoulders, and pulled back his head by the hair.
"Dad!"
she cried. Egan's face was twisted, as though he was in great pain.
"Kelly, save yourself," he said haltingly. "I can't make it."
"Hold on, Dad," she encouraged him. "A boat will pick us up soon." Still clutching the brown case, he pushed it toward her.
"When I fell in the water, I struck this. I must have broken my back. I'm paralyzed and can't swim."
A body floating face down drifted against Kelly, and she fought to keep from gagging as she pushed it away.
"I'll hold on to you, Dad. We can use your hand case as a float."
"Take it," he muttered, forcing her to grab the case. "Keep it safe until the proper time."
"I don't understand."
"You'll know."
He barely got the words out, his face contorted in agony, and he sagged. During the first 30 minutes after the deep encounter arrived at the scene, more than 500 people were pulled out of the water. Another 200 made it to the rafts alongside the deep encounter and were lifted on board by the slings attached to winches. Birch concentrated on keeping the deep encounter from bashing in her hull. With a wary eye on the increasing height of the swell sweeping against the port side of the ship, he boosted the power to the thrusters and Z-drives every time one threatened to shove deep encounter crashing against the massive stern of Emerald Dolphin. It was a battle he did not always win. He winced, knowing that hull plates were being crushed and buckled. Pitt took on the job of masterminding and directing the rescue operation. It seemed he was everywhere, giving orders over his portable radio, pulling survivors from the water, directing the boats to where those in the water had drifted away, helping work the cranes as the boats were brought on board and unloaded. He caught children in midair whose arms and hands had gone numb from the effort, and who had let go of the last 10 feet of line. With no small apprehension, he saw that the ship was becoming dangerously overloaded, with another 1,000 passengers yet to save. He ran up to the pilot house to check with Leo Delgado on the weight distribution. "How bad is it?" Delgado gave a gloomy shake of his head.
"Not good. Add another 3 feet to our draft and we'll become a submarine."
Pitt hurried to the work deck and assembled several of the ship's crew. "We've got to lighten the ship. Cut the anchors and chain and drop free. Hoist the submersibles over the side and let them drift in the water. We can pick them up later. Every piece of equipment that weighs over 10 pounds, toss it overboard." Next, as another weight-saving measure, he instructed the men in the boats as they came alongside. "After you pick up your final haul of survivors, remain adrift next to the ship. But do not send anyone aboard." In that instant, a glimmer of light brown hair caught Pitt's eye, spread on the blue-green water like lace filaments on a satin sheet. A hand made a slight gesture, as if trying to paddle through the water, or was it simply movement caused by the waves? Pitt ran 20 feet down the deck for a closer look. The head rose slightly above the water, far enough for him to see two large, beautiful eyes that appeared languid and dazed.
"Pick her up,"
Pitt yelled to the rescue boat's helmsman, motioning to the woman. But the boat was already halfway around the stern of the Emerald Dolphin, and the helmsman failed to hear him. Without another second's hesitation, Pitt climbed on top of the railing, balanced for a moment, and then dove into the water. He did not immediately rise to the surface, but stroked mightily underwater. 20 feet and he was there, pulling her head from under the water by her hair. Despite her drowned rat appearance, he could see that she was a very attractive young woman. Only then did he notice that she was gripping the handle of some sort of small suitcase that had filled with water and was dragging her down.
"You fool!" he snapped. "Let loose of it!"
"I can't!"
she abruptly hissed with a determination that surprised him.
"And I won't!"
Elated that she wasn't on death's doorstep, he didn't argue the matter, but grabbed her by the halter and began towing her to the deep encounter. When he reached the side of the hull,
Willing hands reached down and pulled her on board. Released from his burden, Pitt climbed up a rope ladder. One of the women scientists threw a blanket around her and was about to guide her down a companionway when Pitt stopped her. He looked into those blue eyes and asked, "What's so important in that briefcase that you almost died trying to save it?" She gave him an exhausted look. "My father's life work." Pitt looked at the case with new respect. "Do you know if your father was saved?" She slowly shook her head and looked forlornly into the ash-coated water with its many floating bodies. "He's down there," she whispered. Then she abruptly turned and disappeared down the companionway. No anthill could have been more congested than the deep encounter when the final survivor was taken on board. Bodies were crammed in the engine room, the scientific storerooms, the laboratories, and the crew and scientists' quarters. They were sitting or stretched out in the lounge, the galley, staterooms, and messroom. Every passageway was full. Five families were crowded into Captain Birch's cabin. The deep encounter was sitting so low that water sloshed over the gunwales onto the work deck whenever the hull was struck by waves higher than 4 feet. Meanwhile, the crew of the Emerald Dolphin did themselves proud. Only when the cruise ship's stern was free of the last passenger did they begin to drop down the lines themselves and board the crowded survey ship. No longer a fireball of raging flame, the Emerald Dolphin was melting down into a dying furnace. The frenzied fire, having attacked and consumed every flammable material, every combustible object, now found nothing left to destroy. The fiberglass hull lifeboats hung grotesquely, having melted into unrecognizable shapes. The great circular decks were drooping down around the hull like the decayed wings of a dead vulture. Consumed by the Holocaust, the entire circular superstructure caved in upon itself under a great billowing pall of smoke. Fresh flames suddenly leaped through the open sides of the hull from explosions deep below. Pitt stared at her with deep sadness, watching a fabulous ship reduced to a ruin. Beside him, McFerrin gazed entranced at the ghastly sepulchre.
"It should never have happened," he said,
his voice quavering with emotion.
"What do you think caused it?"
McFerrin turned from the glowing, twisted hulk, his face strained in anger.
"It was not an act of God, I can tell you that."
"You think it was terrorism?" Pitt asked incredulously.
"There is no doubt in my mind. The fire spread too quickly for it to have been accidental. None of the automated fire warning or fire control systems went into operation, and when they were manually engaged, they refused to function."
Kelly sat dozing on the deck in one of the deep encounter's storerooms when she was awakened by a woman who'd introduced herself earlier as a marine biologist. "Time to move along," she said softly. "A British container ship has arrived and we're transferring everyone over to her." The woman left the storeroom to herd other passengers topside so they could board the container ship's boats. Kelly stiffly rose to her feet. She was almost to the doorway when suddenly she was stopped by a large man. She looked up and found herself staring into the icy features of the red-haired man who had struggled with her father on the cruise ship. He stepped inside the storeroom and slowly closed the door.
"What do you want?" she whispered fearfully.
"Your father's case," he answered in a deep, quiet voice. "You won't be heard if you hand it over. Otherwise, I will have to kill you."
Kelly could see it in the cold black eyes. And something else. The man was going to kill her whether she gave him the case or not. His arms reached out, the hands like claws, and clutched her. She screamed, a high, shrill cry that reverberated in the small storeroom with its steel bulkheads. He lifted her up in one effortless motion. The cold, murderous expression had been replaced by a leer of lust. As if in slow motion, he pressed his lips against hers. She tried to scream again, but all that came out were muffled sobs. Then he pulled back and grinned again.
"Yes,"
he said in a voice that was hard and indifferent.
Scream all you wish. No one can hear you.
His huge hands moved up to her throat and locked around it.
I promise, he said with the emotion of a block of ice. Death will come quick and painless.
Then a voice behind him said, Your technique for romancing women leaves a lot to be desired. The red-haired killer released Kelly's throat and spun around in a movement as quick as a cat's. A shadowy figure was standing in the doorway, one outstretched hand casually resting on the door latch, his face dark and silhouetted by the light behind him in the passageway. Quickly, the killer whipped into a martial arts position, his hands poised in the air, and launched his foot at the intruder. Unknown to the killer and Kelly, Pitt had heard the screams and silently opened the door. In a violent corkscrew motion, he twisted out of the doorway into the passageway as the killer's leg and foot sliced through the air. The intended blow missed Pitt's head by an inch and impacted on the frame of the door. The ankle bone broke cleanly with an audible crack. Any other man would have writhed in agony. Not this one, trained to ignore pain. He came forward, arms and hands moving in martial arts motion. Then he leaped toward his prey, hands chopping the air like axes. Pitt stood as if frozen, feigning fear, until the last microsecond. Then he dropped to the deck and rolled toward his assailant, whose momentum caught him off balance and carried him over and beyond Pitt, tripping on his body and crashing in a heap to the deck. Pitt was on him like lightning. Using every pound of his body, he pinned the man to the deck, digging one knee into an unprotected back and clapping his hands violently against the ears. The man's eardrums burst, and his face twisted into a hideous grimace. He was hurt now, truly hurt. But he was still the aggressor, and he continued his advance toward Pitt, dragging his mangled foot behind him. Pitt backed away, knowing his only advantage was faster footwork. Suddenly, Kelly appeared in the doorway behind the killer, holding the leather case. Pitt saw an opportunity. Run! He shouted to her. The killer hesitated, not certain whether Pitt was trying the age-old bluff, but he was a true professional who studied his victims. He saw the tiny shift in Pitt's eyes and whirled around as Kelly ran toward the stairway leading up to the open work deck. Focusing on his main target, he took off after her, half running, half hobbling, fighting the agony that erupted from his fractured ankle. It was the move Pitt had hoped for. Now it was his turn to attack. He sprinted forward and leaped on the back of the killer. It was a brutal football tackle, using the combined impetus of both bodies to bring the runner down from behind, while ramming his face and head into the ground. Pitt heard his attacker's head hit the thinly carpeted steel deck with a sickening thump and felt the body go limp. Pitt reached down and pressed his fingers against the jugular vein. There was no hint of a pulse. The killer was dead. He looked into the man's unseeing eyes and murmured to himself, I'm as rotten as you are. Then he thought of the woman. The deck was crowded with survivors who were holding on to safety ropes while they moved in line and climbed into the Earl of Wattlesfield's rescue boats for the trip to the British container ship. Pitt rushed through the line searching for her, but she was not in the group that was being transported across the water. It was as if she had vanished. Things were finally looking up for the deep encounter. By late afternoon, except for 10 who were too injured to be moved, all but 100 of the survivors from the Emerald Dolphin had been ferried over to the Earl of Wattlesfield. Without the horde of survivors on board, the battered survey ship rose 5 feet out of the water. The crew then went to work and shored up the badly damaged hull plates, which reduced the incoming flow and enabled the pumps to gain on the flooding. The Australian-guided missile frigate arrived and added their boats to the ferry operation, taking the survivors who dropped down the ropes from the bow and relieving the exhausted boat crews from deep encounter. The first tug to reach the Emerald Dolphin was the Quest Marine Offshore Company's Audacious, At 190 feet in length, with a beam of 58 feet, she was one of the largest tugs in the world. Her twin Honeywell diesel engines provided a total of 9,800 horsepower to drive her propulsion units. Captain Jock McDermott wasted no time. After circling the derelict and seeing that the rudder looked to be set in the flat zero-degree position, he brought the Audacious to within 200 feet of the Emerald Dolphin's bow. He could only hope the rudder was frozen in place. If it moved, the hulk would shear off to the side and become impossible to control. With no power on board the Emerald Dolphin, it was no small chore to lift aboard the tug's massive 8-inch diameter tow cable that weighed 1 ton per 100 feet. By using the bollard as a pulley, the winch was engaged and began pulling the line running between the two ships around a small drum attached to the main winch. A 2-inch cable that had been attached to one end of the line soon began winding itself around the bollard and back to the tug again. The other end of the cable was connected to the big 8-incher, which was then pulled up to the bow of the cruise ship and clamped